From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The savings and loan crisis was one of the most important domestic disasters facing us, and one of the most confusing to follow. On today's Fresh Air, we meet journalist L.J. Davis. He wrote a piece for Harper's Magazine on the SNL mess, tracing the crisis back to where it all began. Also, John Updike joins us to talk about his fourth and final Rabbit novel, Rabbit at Rest. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three new records by pianist Randy Weston. Two of them are devoted to compositions by Weston's musical mentors, Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington. And we remember the great jazz drummer and bandleader Art Blakey. He died yesterday at the age of 71. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate leaders on both sides of the aisle are pressing for quick approval of a deficit reduction plan that President Bush has said he'd be willing to accept. The measure would double gasoline taxes, cut Medicare benefits, and offer a broader-based tax increase than the version passed yesterday by the House. White House Chief of Staff John Sununu said the president is ready to receive a package like the Senate version and will sign it. The administration also said the president might not let the government shut down on Saturday if lawmakers show good faith progress toward a deficit reduction package. The U.S. House followed the lead of the Senate and approved a compromise civil rights bill designed to combat job bias today. The bill effectively overturned six Supreme Court decisions handed down last year. More from Mary Carlin on Capitol Hill.
Most of the Democrats called the bill a step in the right direction for women and minorities, but the Republicans claim the bill will force employers to adopt quotas in hirings and promotions as a ready-made defense in case they are taken to court. President Bush has threatened to veto the measure, which was approved on a 273-154 vote. But Representative Don Edwards, a California Democrat, says Bush will be making a grave mistake if he does.
The president's veto of the Civil Rights Act will have devastating consequences because these damaging Supreme Court cases will not be overturned.
Provisions in the bill range from a ban on racial discrimination in the workplace to awarding punitive damages. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Carlin at the Capitol.
The last of this year's Nobel Prizes were announced today. The recipients are three physicists and a chemist, all of whom did their prize-winning research in the United States. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
This year's chemistry prize goes to Elias James Corey, a professor at Harvard University who has revolutionized the way that drugs, plastics, dyes, and many other chemicals are produced. Among his inventions are chemicals that act like robots to assemble drugs and other complicated molecules in the test tube. The physics prize is shared three ways, by Richard Taylor at Stanford University and Jerome Friedman and Henry Kendall at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. 20 years ago, they discovered subatomic particles called quarks using the two-mile-long Stanford Linear Accelerator. Today, quarks are considered the fundamental building blocks of every atom in the universe. The three physicists will share a $700,000 prize. Chemist E.J. Corey will get $700,000 for himself when the awards are handed out December 10th in Stockholm. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 2,387.87. Advances led declines by 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The General Accounting Office is now predicting that the savings and loan bailout will cost the U.S. government $500 billion. This is one of the most important domestic crises and one of the most difficult to comprehend. An article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine has many people saying, "Now I understand what happened." The article, called Chronicle of a Debacle Foretold, by writer L.J. Davis, traces the SNL crisis from its roots to what Davis calls the most astounding financial scandal the nation has ever witnessed. We've invited L.J. Davis on the show to help unravel the complications of the current crisis. Davis is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His 1987 article, which predicted the stock market crash, won a National Magazine Award. Davis says savings and loan institutions were first created in the U.S. in 1831 with one simple purpose.
They were established to allow thrifty artisans to own their own homes. And the first thrifts, in fact, were simply associations of these thrifty artisans, banded together and deposited sums of money in a central place. And as each person built his home, he withdrew from the system, and when the last person built their home, the fund was closed down. It was called an ideal 3-6-3 business. You paid 3% for your deposits, you lent the money back out at 6%, and you hit the golf course at 3 if you were an SNL executive. The purpose was still to build homes for the American laboring classes and middle classes. In other words, a social purpose. Didn't make a heck of a lot of money, but it also didn't take a whole lot of brains to run. And until the Reagan administration, most of the SNLs in the country were what were called mutual associations. That is, they were still owned by their depositors. And they were amongst the soundest financial institutions in the known universe. Not one mutual association failed during the Great Depression, for example.
Now, you said that by the end of the 1970s, SNLs weren't doing very well. Why not?
Well, if you just look at the economics of the situation, an SNL is going to be literally as sound as a dollar. But an SNL is going to depend on stable interest rates because of what it does. It loans out money in the form of home mortgages. Now, mortgages are what are called in the trade slow assets. A mortgage can last for as long as 30 years. So as long as your interest rates are stable, of course, you can charge the 6% on that 30-year mortgage and see a handsome return, a comfortable return, never a handsome return. If something happens to interest rates, however, if they shoot into the stratosphere, you as an SNL executive are going to find yourself getting killed. And that's precisely what happened in the 1970s. The sequence of events is fairly easy to follow now in retrospect. Everybody thinks the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1936. As a matter of fact, it didn't go off the gold standard until 1971, when President Nixon decided that we weren't going to settle our international accounts in gold and, in effect, declared the nation insolvent. Well, all right, what does this mean? This means that the dollar is now floating around. It's no longer tied to a store of value, and it becomes a highly mobile instrument. Simultaneously, you've got a persistent, intractable inflation going on that was introduced by Lyndon Johnson when he tried to fight a land war in Asia while stoking a boom at home through the simple expedient of printing a lot more money. And inflation occurs in the simplest sense when things get more expensive and you print more money to try to pay the bill. Then in 1972-3, the Arabs saw their opportunities and they took them. And blew the price of oil into the stratosphere, causing everything in the world to briefly become vastly more expensive, and because we printed more money to try to pay the bill, causing the persistent, intractable inflation to escalate until you got double digits by the end of the decade. Well, fine, you're an SNL executive and you're getting your 6% return, but you need your depositor base, or else you're going to go out of business. And your depositors see that money markets, which are uninsured, are offering money market rates, 13, 14, 15% for your money. So you have a sudden exodus, what looks like a disastrous, catastrophic exodus of money from the SNLs into money market funds as people try, intelligently, to deploy their savings to take advantage of and also to counter the inflationary pressures. And so the SNLs, around 1980, look like they're going broke.
Why did Congress start to deregulate the SNLs?
Well, deregulation was in the air ever since the early 1970s report that was commissioned by President Nixon. Deregulation, in some cases, looked really good. But as with everything in Washington, what starts off as a good idea became first a fad and then a frenzy. And especially with the arrival of the Reagan administration and its determination to get government off the backs of the American people and out of the pocket of the American businessman. They not merely wanted to deregulate everything. They wished the government to go away entirely, including the government as represented by the oversight of America's financial institutions.
Congress started to deregulate the SNLs in the late 70s. You say they went about it backwards. How did they go about it backwards?
Well, if you are going to deregulate a savings and loan institution, what you should do, one thing, actually, they should have done precisely nothing and wait for the business cycle to turn, which would cause the deposits to flow back into the SNLs, as happened anyway. But if you're going to deregulate these things, what you do first is you allow them to adjust their income stream, where they make their money, and where they make their money is in their mortgage portfolio. So you allow them to have something that they have long wanted, which is something called an adjustable rate mortgage. That is, the SNL can adjust the rate of its mortgages to reflect the economic realities of the greater society. Then, after a period of time has elapsed, and this can be a couple of years or maybe even a little bit longer, you then allow them to deregulate the interest they pay to their depositors. You bring that back up to free market. If you don't do it that way, if you do it the way that they actually did do it, a bank is going to be literally shoveling money out of its door. What they did was, because many people in America regarded as cheap mortgages as a God-given right, they left mortgage rates right where they were, but they allowed the banks to pay any kind of interest for deposits that they wanted to. Desperate for funds, of course, the banks jacked their rates up to compete with money market interest rates. And so what you had was banks that were paying 13 and 14% to their depositors and only receiving 6 to 9% on their mortgages, which is, A, did it backwards, and B, it had the result I just described, as anybody who can figure with a stub of a pencil on the back of an envelope can see. You're shoveling money out the door.
In 1980, Congress raised the insurance of an SNL account from $40,000 to $100,000. In other words, if you had $40,000 in an SNL account, that would have been insured. But after 1980, you could have had as much as $100,000, and it would be insured by the federal government. There was no hearing. There was no debate about raising the amount that was insured by the federal government. What was the rationale for raising it from $40,000 to $100,000?
Well, the ostensible rationale is to catch up with inflation. Now, let's do a little thing here on what deposit insurance is for. When Franklin Roosevelt decided to regulate the SNLs, he was intensely suspicious of deposit insurance, that is, that the government would stand behind the SNL and guarantee that if somebody kept his deposit below a certain threshold, that person would never lose any money if the SNL failed. President Roosevelt was intensely suspicious of this because he didn't want the SNL executives making bets on the public nickel, that is, taking those deposits, federally insured, and going out with the wild sense of abandon that comes with knowing that you are throwing away money you simply cannot lose because it's guaranteed by the federal government. So deposit insurance was historically kept rather low. It had ratcheted up, as you say, to about $40,000 in 1980. But the actual rationale for this, ratcheting up to $100,000 for each deposit, was to allow the banks, or the SNLs, to attract large amounts of capital. In fact, at this level, an SNL could attract a virtually unlimited amount of capital. So the country's awash in money, despite its somewhat parlous economic condition, because of all the petrodollars that are floating around in the system. And a lot of this money is looking for a home. Now, it's in the hands of institutions, pension funds, endowment funds, insurance companies, investment banks, stock brokerages, and so on. Now, you've got a lot of surplus cash lying around these places, and you're looking for a place to put it. If an SNL could pay a handsome rate of interest, of course, that would attract the attention of all these custodians of the surplus cash. And it was especially attractive because it made your task a lot easier with the federal $100,000 cap on insurance. You could put your money in somewhat larger packages, deposit it in a savings and loan, receive a handsome rate of interest, and know that this money was absolutely safe. It's a no-brainer bet. because the American taxpayer is going to have to pay it back if the SNL goes out of business.
Let's get back to FDR. And you said that he was suspicious of federal insurance of SNL accounts because he felt that this could lead to a certain irresponsibility on the part of bankers. They could do anything and think, well, heck, I mean, the money's insured. The feds will take care of it. So what Roosevelt did was put a lot of regulations into effect to ensure the responsibility of the bankers. Now, what we have when the insurance is raised from $40,000 to $100,000, we simultaneously have deregulation going on. So it's kind of exactly the opposite of what Roosevelt had in mind.
Absolutely. This whole catastrophe occurred because of a very simple thing. If you give criminals an opportunity to steal money, they'll do it. Look, you raise the ante by insuring the money up to $100,000, and then you say anybody can own an SNL, provided he looks like he's got enough money to buy it. You're going to have and you also say that you're going to cut the examination force, and you're reducing all sorts of regulations, and you're cutting down the amount of capital he has to have on hand. And in states like California, which has a state-chartered savings and loan system, distinct from the federal system, but still federally insured, a piece of legislation called the Nolan Act was passed that said that an owner of an SNL could invest the deposits in his custody in anything he could think of. He could buy Antarctic real estate, mushroom farms. There was one SNL in California that was particularly fond of things that had to do with manure. Reprocessing plants, power from manure. It also bought a lot of, subsidized a lot of windmill farms. All this money's lost, of course. That was simply foolish. In the cases that we see arising in California, Texas, Florida, perhaps even in Colorado, where the president's son is involved, what we witness instead is outright criminality. People taking advantage of the liberal state laws. These things mostly happen at state-chartered, not federally chartered associations, to make all sorts of lunatic loans. Now, I happen to have gotten hold of the examination reports from Lincoln SNL, the one that Charles H. Keating got hold of in Southern California. And a child wouldn't have made these loans. These loans are range from the ludicrous to the outright fraudulent. You had people being loaned their own down payment. You had people being loaned enough money to make to keep the payments current for 2 years, whereupon the loan could be refinanced. You had the loans being made without paperwork, without applications, without credit checks, without appraisals of the collateral, without any collateral whatever. You had down payments being channeled through third parties. Why would anybody do something like this? This is giving away the bank's money.
Yeah, why would they do it?
Well, every time you make a loan, you post it on your book as a profitable loan because at first it seems to be. You've charged points. Anybody who's ever gone to a bank and tried to do this knows exactly what they have to do. There are origination fees. There are all sorts of other kinds of fees. And this produces a profit on the bank's book. The loan can be absolutely insane, and many of them were.
So this is to make yourself look like you're making a profit on paper.
That's right, because if you're making a profit on paper, you can either pay yourself handsome dividends or... Nothing you can do if you've got this immensely profitable-looking association is you can pay yourself a gigantic salary. If you're intimately involved with the affairs of the association, the way an entrepreneur named Don Ray Dixon was in Dallas at his SNL, Vernon, you can have the bank pay for your wedding. You can have the association pay to fly you to Europe to examine the great cafes of France because you're planning to open a cafe in Dallas. You can have it pay for your houses and so on. You can have this happen in part because the administration, the Reagan administration in Washington, refuses to pay any attention to what you're doing, except that when what you're doing is called to the attention of, say, Secretary of the Treasury Donald Regan, who thought this was a terrific idea, when you point out to him that savings and loan entrepreneurs are suddenly sporting giant pinky rings, driving around in blue Rolls Royces, building marble-clad, gold-plated towers and occupying huge mansions, Secretary Regan took it as proof positive that the Reagan plan was working, that he had unleashed the entrepreneurial energies of a lot of people. In place of that, of course, we were being robbed blind.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is L.J. Davis, and he's chronicled the SNL crisis in an article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. And Davis is a contributing editor to Harper's. This is Fresh Air. L.J. Davis is my guest, and we're talking about the SNL crisis. Looking back on the SNL crisis, who do you think are the main culprits in causing the crisis?
Well, this is a wonderful bipartisan crisis as far as the culprits are concerned. The principal culprit, of course, is the Reagan administration, with their lunatic belief in any kind of deregulation, which led them to deregulate financial institutions that were making huge bets with federally insured money, which is by itself insane. So the principal villains here, I would say, would be Secretary of the Treasury and later Chief of Staff Donald Regan, who recently went before the House Banking Committee and made the astonishing statement that the problem was caused by not enough deregulation not too much of it. You'd think, of course, that the democratically controlled Congress might give us some oversight and might actually make some political hay off the problems that are now suddenly occurring as a result of deregulation in the SNLs. But no such thing happened. We've often wondered how much the United States Congress is worth, and now I think we can put a dollar figure to it. The SNL barons were able to buy the services of the United States Congress for $11 million.
Now, what are you referring to?
That's how much they made in campaign contributions to a broad spectrum of congressmen and senators on both sides of the aisles. And the docility that they purchased throughout the early period of this crisis, in fact, up until 1988, is literally astonishing. Such unlikely heroes of this affair as Ronald Reagan's own chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Ed Gray, attempted time after time after time to warn the Congress about what was happening. He explained it until he was blue in the face. He's like the ancient mariner now who stoppeth one in three trying to explain what happened. He gives out copies of speeches he gave in 1983, 84, trying to alert the Congress. But the Congress was utterly inert, amazingly enough.
And you're saying this is because people in Congress got up to $11 million total from SNLs in campaign contributions.
Yes, well, this may seem like a fairly bold statement, but it is a miracle on the order of the loaves and the fishes for any constituent to get two senators, much less five senators, in a room lobbying on his behalf. And yet that is precisely what happened with the so-called Keating Five. Senators Cranston, DeConcini, McCain, Glenn, and Riegler. Lobbying intensely for an SNL baron in Southern California, Charles H. Keating, whose failed Lincoln savings and loan is probably going to cost us more than $2 billion. Trying to, in effect, get the examination of this of Lincoln called off. As it happened, the examiners were finding, to their horror, that Lincoln was a wide open bucket shop and were recommending that be shut down at once. Nonetheless, Charles H. Keating, who was generous in his campaign contributions to all five of these senators, and who had hired Senator Glenn's former administrative assistant, made him a vice president of his company. Anyway, Charles Keating was able to get the five senators in a room, and they were real tough.
What's your assessment of President Bush's bailout plan?
President Bush's bailout plan is, to put a word to it, fraudulent. The actual cost of closing the SNLs that we know are amongst the living dead is going to be minimum $200 million. Yet the General Accounting Office says that this thing's going to cost us $500 billion minimum before we finally get out of this. Where are the discrepancy? Well, the fact of the matter is that both Congress and the President are desperate to keep the SNL crisis off the budget. So they're not paying for it directly with taxpayer money. Indirectly, they are. In place of that, they're selling bonds. This is what's called an off-budget item. Whenever you sell a bond, you've got to pay interest to the bondholder. So for every dollar that you and I and the American taxpayer spend to close down one of these lunatic SNLs, we're going to have to pay $1.50 in interest. And meanwhile, they're pretending that it's not part of the budget deficit because they're keeping it over here in the Resolution Trust Corporation and selling the bonds.
Did you say for every dollar we have to pay $1.50 in interest?
That's right.
We're paying 150% in interest?
That's how much it's going to be over the 40-year life of the bonds.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
And furthermore, bear in mind that that's a minimum figure. The $500 billion, the half-trillion bucks in both closure expenses and interest, is what we can count right now. A lot of these associations were running wide open with no paperwork. So what the examiners are doing right now is trying to find out where else all the rest of the money went. And this is really hard to do if nobody wrote anything down. That figure is sure to get larger.
What's the next thing you're looking at in the SNL crisis? What's the next big issue or big trial on the horizon?
Let me think. Well, the ongoing circus at Silverado Savings Loan involving the president's son, Neil Bush, is certainly a lot of fun. By and large, most of this is over now. Now we got to pay the bill. What we're going to end up with is not much of a savings and loan system left in the country, and therefore the noble social purpose of providing inexpensive mortgages to thrifty artisans may go by the boards. This crisis, however, is over. It's been shut down. And now it just costs us an awful lot of money. That's not the only thing that's going to cost us an awful lot of money, because our friends in Washington are also trying to balance the books by looting the Social Security system, but that's another story.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And L.J. Davis is the author of an article on the SNL crisis that was published in the September issue of Harper's Magazine, where he's a contributing editor. Next time, syndicated columnist Roger Simon shares tales from covering the 88 presidential election and evaluates President Bush's continuing performance in the media. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
Well, definitely.
Baby, you know I need me some gold. Romance without finance just don't make sense.
It sure don't.
Mama, mama, please give up that gold. You so great and you so fine. You ain't got no money, you can't be mine. It ain't no joke to be stone broke. Baby, you know I ain't lying when I say romance without finance is a nuisance.
You're not kidding, brother.
Please, please, baby, give me some gold.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember the great drummer and bandleader Art Blakey with excerpts from a 1979 interview with him. For over four decades now, Harry Rabbit Engstrom has lived in a world created by writer John Updike. Now the story of Rabbit is ended with Updike's final novel in the series, Rabbit at Rest. Coming up, John Updike tells us about the chapter in his own life this novel concludes. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Portraits of Duke Ellington, Portraits of Thelonious Monk, and Self-Portraits, all by pianist Randy Weston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The Senate today began debating a deficit reduction plan that's supported by the leadership of both parties in the Senate and by President Bush. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Senate plan sticks closely to the outlines of the budget summit agreement. It would double the gasoline tax, limit itemized deductions for people with incomes over $100,000, but it would leave income tax rates alone. That puts it at odds with a Democrat-backed plan passed by the House of Representatives last night. That plan, approved on a party-line vote, would leave the gas tax alone, raise rates on the richest taxpayers to 33%, and offer a tax preference for capital gains geared to middle-income investors. Many Democratic leaders in the Senate would have preferred a plan that looked more like the one passed by the House, but they pledged to defend the bipartisan Senate plan against all amendments, including amendments from Democratic senators, who will try to alter the Senate plan tonight so that it, too, puts more of the tax burden on the richest taxpayers. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
$18 billion would be cut from President Bush's proposed debt defense budget under a compromise worked out today by House and Senate negotiators. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
Taking a big hit in the compromise package is the Star Wars space-based defense program, which would only get about two-thirds of the budget originally requested by the White House. But another controversial program that was in danger of being cut out altogether would be allowed to continue for an additional year. The B-2 stealth bomber can evade enemy radar, but it is the most expensive military plane ever built. Under today's compromise, Congress will have to review the program again next year, leaving open the possibility that the B-2 could get cut then. This compromise package also calls for about 20,000 more troops to be eliminated than the White House had wanted. Experts on defense issues in Congress say this compromise package reflects the diminished threat from the Soviet Union. The military budget plan still has to be voted on by both houses of Congress and then signed by the president. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
Some members of a key Senate panel say President Bush should have congressional approval before sending U.S. troops into combat with Iraq. In an appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, Secretary of State James Baker promised only consultation. Baker said he wasn't there for a constitutional debate with lawmakers over whether the president has the authority to commit forces. Commercials during children's television will be limited under a bill that President Bush said today he'll allow to become law. Bush said he'll neither sign nor veto the measure, which will allow 10.5 minutes of ads during an hour of children's programming on the weekend, 12 minutes during weekdays. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 7 points to 2387.87. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in active trading of 161 million shares. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. I'll talk with John Updike later on the show about his new novel, Rabbit at Rest. Jazz pianist Randy Weston was born in Brooklyn, hung out in New York with Thelonious Monk, and lived in Tangiers in North Africa for 10 years. He's played with modern jazz groups and with Moroccan ensembles. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Weston's music sounds both African and American. Kevin has a review of three new Weston albums.
Randy Weston's set of three new albums, recorded on three consecutive days in Paris last year, is a major event in jazz. Verve Records put out the first two volumes over the summer. They're called Portraits of Duke Ellington and Portraits of Thelonious Monk, and they feature the works of those composers. The last installment, a set of Weston originals called Self-Portraits, comes out this month. The series is part genealogical chart and part roadmap. Weston uses these recordings to identify his musical forebears and to show what he's picked up on his own travels. That's Randy Weston playing Duke Ellington's blues, Sepia Panorama. By interpreting the music of Ellington and Monk, Weston emphasizes how much his piano style has in common with theirs. Like them, Randy Weston hits the keys hard, so the piano strings really ring and their overtones can really sing out. And like them, Weston often pairs his lines down to a minimum of notes. Monk and Ellington are Weston's musical father and grandfather, but he's his own man with his own way of doing things. You can hear that when he plays Monk's famous minimal blues, Misterioso. Here's a snippet of how Monk and most everyone else plays it. Randy Weston breaks up that regular pattern. He puts his own rhythmic stamp on the tune to bring out its blues roots. Weston's rhythmic concept is one of the most striking things about his ensemble music. Half the credit goes to the band. His quartet has a very African feel, although only hand drummer Eric Asante hails from Africa. He's from Ghana. Bassist Jamil Nasser and trap drummer Idris Muhammad come from the American South. Lots of jazz pianists demonstrate their understanding that the piano is really a percussion instrument. But Randy Weston is one of the few whose whole band operates like a West African drum choir, with the piano on an equal footing with the other drums. Even the bass has a percussive role. Here's part of Weston's piece for his father, Portrait of Frank Edward Weston. Of course, American jazz claims West African music as one of its ancestors. But Randy Weston is one of those rare musicians who draws the two so close together in practice, he makes you hear the family resemblance. That's why his portraits sound exotic and familiar at the same time. Their conceptual sweep and their invigorating physicality combine to place these albums not only among Weston's best recordings, but among the best jazz piano sessions of recent years.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Randy Weston's three new albums are on Verve. This is Fresh Air. John Updike didn't want to leave the story of Harry Rabbit Angstrom unfinished. With the fourth Rabbit novel, Rabbit at Rest, Updike completes the series and completes the story of an American life. Each of the Rabbit novels are set in the last year of the decade, beginning with Rabbit Run in 1959. When we meet Rabbit, he's in his late 20s, a former high school basketball star living in a small Pennsylvania town. He's dissatisfied with life, alienated from his wife and child. As the books progress, Rabbit inherits his late father-in-law's car dealership. He's prosperous. He has extramarital affairs. But he's still dissatisfied. He remains alienated in 1989 in the final novel. He's overweight, 55 years old, and living in retirement half the year in Florida. His heart is bad. He's losing his drive. His life is running down. And he's in debt because his son has been stealing money from the family car dealership to feed his coke habit. Like Rabbit, Updike is from a small town in Pennsylvania, but the author has led a very different life from his character. Yet the Rabbit novels are marvelously detailed. I asked Updike how he knows so much about Rabbit.
He's not so different from me. He's about my age, so that's easy. And I know about Pennsylvania and the details of how to run the car dealership I tried to work up in the preceding novel, although there isn't an awful lot of that kind of detail here. The rest is a matter of faith, really. You construct these dolls, and then you throw yourself at them and hope that they'll walk and talk and that you'll be able to know what goes on in their heads. And I've never had trouble making Harry do things or having access to what seems to be a very busy mind of his. He's always reflecting and seeing and making remarks to himself, and in that sense, he's a very responsive character.
There are very detailed descriptions of heart procedures like angioplasty in your book. How was your health during the writing of this book? The character Rabbit is constantly experiencing chest pains, even from the first page. Were you undergoing anything of the sort yourself?
Well, I think my chest has always been one of my weak points, and I did have chest pains. I found that they ceased, though, once I stopped writing the book. The book kind of weighed on my chest, and I had to, as they say, get it off my chest. So, yeah, I felt kind of frail and squeezed. He also talks about that feeling of being squeezed. But that's very Rabbit-like, isn't it? I mean, life itself squeezes him in ways he doesn't like, and his whole exertion is to get away from the squeeze of circumstances. Yeah, but in answer to your question, I felt slightly under the weather while I was writing this book, but nothing drastic. I went to the doctor, and he said it was all in my mind, or that I was, considering how old I was in pretty good shape.
I want you to read a scene in which Rabbit is undergoing the procedure of angioplasty.
I will try to read this very complex scene. It's already happening when we begin the reading, and the doctors, I guess, are self-explanatory. Another double cross. They shave him down beside his privates without warning where the catheter will go in. They give him a pill to make him light in the head, and then when he's helpless on the operating table, under all these lights, they scrape away at the right half of his groin area and pubic bush. He's never had much body hair and wonders if at his age it will ever grow back. The needle that follows feels bigger and meaner than the Novocaine needle the dentist uses. It's pinch, Dr. Raymond murmurs. Now you'll feel a pinch. Doesn't let go as quickly. But then there's no pain. Just an agony of mounting urinary pressure as the dyes build up in his system, injected repeatedly with a hot surge like his chest is being cooked in a microwave. Jesus. He closes his eyes a few times to pray, but it feels like a wrong occasion. There's too much crowding in of the actual material world. No old wispy biblical god would dare interfere. The one religious consolation he clings to through his 3.5-hour ordeal is a belief that Dr. Raymond, with his desert tan and long melancholy nose and bearish pack of fat across his shoulders, is Jewish. Harry has this Gentile prejudice that Jews do everything a little better than other people. Something about all those generations crouched over the Torah and watch repair tables. They aren't as distracted as other persuasions. They don't expect to have as much fun. They stay off booze and dope and have a weakness only, if that history of Hollywood he once read can be trusted, for broads.
The reason why I asked you to read this section is that I think it kind of illustrates in a way that as Rabbit is approaching his death, nothing is ever particularly profound for him. Do you know what I mean? He's going through the details of life. He still maintains all of his prejudices. He still is very alienated from his family. He's still cheating on his diet and cheating on his wife. And he's looking death in the face, and it's still that way. And, you know, a lot of times in literature, death is a is a time for great revelation.
Solemn
and profundity.
Occasion, usually,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and revelation and profundity, which doesn't happen to Rabbit.
Well, gosh, maybe a more profound author would have made his dying more profound. But my guess is that physical decline, which doesn't have to be named as death. I mean, you know, there's that in us which refuses to face death, even though we're right on our deathbed. There's that in us which knows only yes and yes, I'm alive. I thought for a man of this sort, and indeed for men and women of all sorts, dying is just one more phase of living, and that we do it with the same equipment that we lived with. And if your brain is trivial, it'll keep on being trivial right to the end.
Rabbit is a surprisingly complex character in a way. I mean, we're always reading what's going on in his mind. But in a lot of ways, he's not a very likable character. He's very prejudiced against gays, against people of certain religions and ethnic groups. He cheats on his wife. He has an affair with his daughter-in-law in the book and feels absolutely no remorse about it and can't see why anybody else is getting so upset about it. Do you get a lot of grief for that, people assuming that you're crude yourself and that you have no feelings?
Some of the reviews seem to suggest that Harry's thoughts are my thoughts, which isn't quite the case. As to his prejudices, I think he's kind of working on them. It is true he has these thoughts, but he doesn't really act on them. And I think that the 30 years that we've known Harry, he's learned quite a lot about acceptance, and you certainly see your normal life brings you into contact with a greater variety of people ethnically than it used to. So he's trying to grow and adjust, to give him credit. As to the he isn't much given to guilt and remorse. No, it's true. I think that though in this book his wife sort of has the upper hand. So anything he does that hurts her is mitigated by the fact that he feels she's basically winning. She is more alive than he as the book goes on.
What have you ended in your own writing career and in your own inner life by ending the Rabbit series?
It's basically the connection to Pennsylvania. I was a native Pennsylvanian and really very much a Pennsylvanian until I went off to college in New England at the age of 18. And at first, the connection was very powerful. I was homesick, and nothing seemed real to me except a shoe fly pie and sauerkraut. And but I've been a New Englander now for many years, and one by one, my contacts with Pennsylvania have lessened, and my mother's death this last year was the final reason I had to visit Pennsylvania. So suddenly, I'm without a real reason to go there, and it seemed to me I could see this coming, and was one of the things that made me want to make this the last before my Pennsylvania becomes entirely fantastic and entirely nostalgic.
Is it an end of a period stylistically for you as well?
It's the end, I think, of the old present tense novels. I've enjoyed picking up that, by the way. I found when I began to write in the present tense what fun it is, how it glides along, and certain kinds of things it excludes. So in a way, you must be more concrete in a sense than with the historical past. And I'll miss the present tense, although many younger writers have taken it up now, so I don't feel the present tense is in danger of withering away. But it kind of cleans the desk, and I feel a sort of blank ahead of me that I'm anxious to start filling.
You've said that you see Rabbit at Rest as a depressed book about a depressed man written by a depressed man. What were you depressed about while writing it?
I'm getting depressed about that sentence, actually.
Because it's been quoted so much?
Well, I've seen it quite a lot. Yeah. And but it was true enough. I did say it. It was at this speech I gave, and it sort of popped into my head, and it seemed true enough. It was a kind of uphill book. Maybe all books are more uphill than we remember. It's a little like childbirth. You tend to erase the pain and just enjoy the product. But as I was writing it, I was aware that this man, not much happens to him, and he's tired. He's tired of living. Maybe I'm tired of writing. A certain tiredness seemed to creep in, and that was all right, I thought, because this is, after all, late middle age novel, and maybe the author's mood and the mood of the prose should reflect the mood of the main character. But I was not displeased when I finally finished, and even more pleased when I could deliver the finished manuscript to Knopf and start thinking about something else.
One last question. Are you going to miss Harry Engstrom?
Oh, I kind of miss him already. The thing about a character in a book, though, he's sort of always there, isn't he? I will miss having in my future one more rabbit novel, but I think it is time I began to concentrate on some other kind of novel and began to write it, in fact.
Do you know what that will be?
Only very vaguely. I think it'll be first person, though. I seem to like first person novels, although in a way that's a cop-out because you are stuck then with the voice and the character. But and I'd like this novel to be shorter than this and a little more antic, a little shorter paragraphs.
Well, John Updike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Updike's new and final rabbit novel is Rabbit at Rest. It's published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a civil rights bill to fight against job bias, and the White House will probably not like the bill. President Bush has promised to veto the measure. He's afraid that hiring quotas would be put into place. Two big stories tonight, the year anniversary of the big earthquake in San Francisco. Isabel Alegria has the year after story about the event and the aftermath and the rebuilding. Also, NPR's Alan Tomlinson has a chronology of the events at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem a week ago Monday when 21 Palestinians were killed, and the Nobel Prize Awards in Chemistry and Physics explained by NPR's Richard Harris.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
I just became known as the little drummer who dropped the bombs.
The incomparable drummer Art Blakey died yesterday of lung cancer at the age of 71. One of the most important figures in the history of jazz, Blakey created a new set of rhythms to drive the new bebop sound. From 1954 until his death, he led his own band, the Jazz Messengers. It developed a style that became known as hard bop. The Messengers also functioned as one of the most important schools for young jazz musicians. Its alumni included Clifford Brown, Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard, Jackie McLean, Wayne Shorter, Horace Silver, Wynton and Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard. Today we remember Art Blakey with an excerpt of an interview I recorded with him in 1979.
We always had bands. I've always been that way, and the reason why I'm a musician today, I think it was survival. I had to survive. I'm a depression baby. I was born when people were living in lean-tos and selling nickel five-cent apples at that time. I saw the crash when the country was off the gold standard. It was horrible. I saw that. I was working in the coal mines. I was trying to go to school, and I wasn't yet 12 years old, but we were trying to survive. And I started playing piano, and I played by ear. So I started making up tunes, and I worked in a nightclub, and I made up dirty tunes, and that's where I made a living. And I made more money than anybody in the household at that time. And I had a 15-piece band. Yeah, I was 13 years old. I had a 15-piece band. We made more money. We wore tails every night, and the guys made $15 a week. I had my own room, my own car, and going to work at Steel Mill and still in junior high school, you see. And that time, it was something else. And where my family, they would they couldn't make $100 a month. Sometimes I'd make that in one night, you see. At that time, you know, it was so way back, Prohibition, about the end of Prohibition. And at that time, I had to play. And I had a family. When I became 15, I was a father. And I played piano. I had the big band, and we had a big show come in. I couldn't cut the show, and there's a little guy sitting over in the corner there wiping his nose, you know, on his shirt sleeves. He said, "Can I try this tune, Mr. Brown?" I said, "Sure, go ahead." And he played it. Played it so well. He couldn't read music either, but he could play better than I could. He turned out to be Earl Garner. So the boss said, "Well, Blakey, you play the drums." I said, "I don't feel like playing no drums. It's my band anyway." He said, "How long you been?" I said, 2 years. He said, "You want to stay here?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, you play the drums." Earl Garner was the piano player. You see, and that's where I became a drummer.
Drummer Art Blakey. He died yesterday in Manhattan at the age of 71. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy. Roberta Sherrock directed our show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look at presidential politics with syndicated columnist Roger Simon of the Baltimore Sun. He's the author of the new book, Roadshow. Also, a memoir of growing up as the hearing child of deaf parents. That and more on the next Fresh Air.